Hello and welcome to Post Combat Normal. My name is Joe Morgan. I'm your host. I am a combat marine with a couple of different tours in a couple of different places. We'll get to that in a later episode. But today I want to start. We're going to be doing a 12-week program that is run through the Citrus Heights Vet Center. It's the exact same program that they do there. Basically, the concept is it is a 12-week program that teaches you what PTSD is and gets you ready to basically move forward into the trauma therapy side of things. So what I wanted to start today with is something I wrote a while ago when I very first started their class. I'm actually through the entire class. Let me start that there. I'm actually through the entire class, and I wanted to say something so that you guys could understand where I'm coming from with this and why I wanted to bring this to you and why I want the two people I have with me today to talk to you. So I'm just going to read you the letter that I wrote them, and it was after, I think, the second class I took with them. But either way, listen to it. And I like to call this the button, and here it is. So, as class ended today, I had an epiphany. If there was a button that I could push that would take away my PTSD, I'm not sure if I would push it. It dawned on me that I'm not sure if I'm ready to heal. I'm afraid of letting go of the warrior in myself, afraid of letting go of the bitterness, and afraid of letting go of the sorrow at the losses suffered. There's a part of my mind that still wants to be on a combat patrol. Wants to feel the power of a weapon in my hand and the high chirp of a radio in my ear. That moment that you have a man in your sights and you slow your breathing for the shot. The moments that still, even as I write this, get my blood pumping and my senses placed on high alert. The rush is addictive. It's a drug that I can hardly shake. And now I subsidize it with old videos from my unit and military channel movies on my war. I can only watch them when no one is around and I have to decompress for a few hours afterwards. I cry like a child for no reason when I watch them. At the pain and the loss. Sometimes I cannot even say why I cry. I know that I should never watch these videos again, but I will. I know I will. I know that they're not good for me, but the memory is my penance. The crying and the pain is my payment for not dying when I should have, when so many of my brothers did. I do not have PTSD. I am PTSD. I am the disorder that lives in this worthless society to remind others of the pain suffered supposedly for their sake. I have a whole list of fears that pop into my mind when I think of the upcoming changes this class will bring to me, and here are the top few. I'm not sure that if I let go of these things, that I will still be me, or at least the me I now identify with. If I stop being that person, I'm afraid of who or what I'll become. My second fear is that I'm not sure if I want to let go of the grief for those lost. Some have said that this has to do with my way of honoring their memory, but I'm not sure. The third one is, if I drop this pack, who will remember what happened? Who will care about those who no longer have voices? Who will be the walking dead? If not me, then who? If I move on, will their memory live in me? Will it change when I change? Part of my epiphany moment was that the exact thing I'm afraid of will probably be the thing that cures me. The problem with this thought is I simply do not know how to sever the line in my brain that continually holds on to the old me and will not let me move forward. I know that I want to heal, but how can I be ready? How can I cut that line? In my thoughts, I see it as an actual rope holding me in place, but I cannot think of a way to untie myself from it. For my wife, for my children, and for my family, I know that I must do this. I know that I must heal. I'm just not sure how. I know that there's a reason that this has such a hold on me, but I'm not really sure why. If there are any people who felt this or know the answer, I would love to hear it. Thanks, Joe Morgan. So again, I wrote that, like I said, about the second class that I went to with these people. And I can tell you now, I am so glad I wrote it, so glad I remembered that, because there's nothing more powerful to start this off than my own fear. My own fear of letting go of my friends. My own fear of not understanding how that carrying someone differently is not carrying them worse. Putting them in a happy memory in my mind instead of a horrifying memory in my mind didn't make me love my brothers any less. It didn't make me less of a man to cry in front of other men. It didn't make me less of a man to face my PTSD. And I want you guys to understand the reason we're doing this is because we want you to face your PTSD. We want you to understand that healing does not make you weak. Healing makes you stronger. It's stronger for yourself, stronger for those you love, stronger for your children, your wives, your mothers and fathers, stronger for the school you're about to attend or the job you are attending. Whatever you're doing, you will do it better. You will be a better person if you just face this demon and put it down now. I'm a Marine. My brain says headbutt it till it dies. I want you to understand that that's how you deal with this. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and move on, and I'm just going to introduce my two guests today. I have Dr. Robert Schneider from the Citrus Heights Vet Center. He has been working with PTSD for quite a while. They have an amazing program there. Again, I'm going to get into that a lot deeper later. In fact, they're going to get into it a lot deeper. And then my other guest today is Doc Fink. And Doc Fink is actually Robert Fink. Is a combat medic in Vietnam, and he has a whole lot of stories that I want him to share with you and a lot of great insight to tell you how the Citrus Heights Vet Center works. Because he's not a doctor, he has a different insight. So either way, I wanted to welcome him. Dr. Schneider, welcome.
Hello.
And Doc Fink, welcome. It's good to have you, brother.
Hello.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to them almost immediately. I just wanted to say welcome to the program. And here we go. Again, we're going to be called Post-Combat Normal, and Dr. Schneider has something to say on that right off.
Well, I want to thank you for having us. It's an honor to be here, Joe. I think the name that you've selected for this podcast is a really good one. Doc Fink can explain sort of the history of why we don't use the D in our program. PTSD is the term that's used out there, but we've dropped the D because we think it's pejorative, and as this is Doc Fink's phrase, that it's a post-combat normal condition.
Go ahead and give me this. What does pejorative mean for those of us who are jarheads in the world?
Oh, derogatory. Sorry, jarheads.
Outstanding.
We haven't used, this is Robert Fink. They call me Doc because I was a medic in Vietnam during 1966 and 1967. I spent a number of months on a surgical research team, sewing guys up, trying to put them back together again, and then I worked in special operations in the field for some number of months. The term PTSD isn't used in our program because I think the origin of dropping the D goes way back to the to the Boston VA when Dr. Jonathan Shea was working with Marines who got fed up with the term disorder, because disorder implies something that is abnormal. And we don't consider ourselves abnormal. We consider ourselves post-combat normal. When you're in combat, when you see your friends, your team members die, when you have to hold somebody as they're dying, this has a significant effect on you. And before I go any further in that direction, I want to quote something that is from Sergeant Ty Michael Carter, who received the Congressional Medal of Honor from Obama, President Obama, in the White House in 2009 for heroic actions in Afghanistan. And Sergeant Carter said, "I would like to see the media drop D from post-traumatic stress disorder. The condition is not a disorder. It is only a normal reaction to the horrors of war." Now, let me go a little bit further and say, although we consider ourselves normal, we have some issues. We bring some issues home with us that are less than normal and that are difficult for us to deal with once we once we return from combat. Some of the behaviors that you adopt in the theater of war, you adopt because you're forced to adopt them. You're forced to survive. You have to kill or be killed. You have to numb yourself. Dr. Melinda Keenan, who founded our program, often says that when you come home from war, you come home either in a straitjacket, in a box, or numb. And the downside to coming home numb is that we bring that emotional numbness back home to our friends and to our families, to our wife, to our children. We are emotionally withdrawn. Another adaptive characteristic that we assume in combat is anger, because it is very functional in terms of dealing with the enemy. But you have to disgorge that from your psyche when you come home to be able to function effectively in a normal society. I recall vividly when I got on the plane on my way back to Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, D.C. from Vietnam. I just sat there in the plane thinking this nightmare is finally over and I'm going home. And all the things that I did, the things that I saw, that I witnessed, that I was ashamed of or uncomfortable with came flowing back through my mind, and I dumped them all, metaphorically speaking, dumped them all in the on the tray table in this on the seat in front of me, and swept them in a little pile and put them in a container and put the lid on that container as tight as I possibly could, and then I buried that container in my heart. And that's where it stayed. It stayed for 40 plus years. But the memories that I had were so toxic that over time they break the seals down on that container and they just drip, drip, drip into your body, into your psyche. And you aren't even, as a combat veteran, you aren't even aware that this poisoning is occurring. You become agitated, you become hypervigilant, you become angry too easy. Like I mentioned before, you're emotionally withdrawn. Other people, especially family members, begin to see these characteristics way before you see them. You think that this is just who I am. It's not who you are, it's who you have become. And our mission, therapeutically, with veterans is to help them learn to deal with the horrors of war so that they can live more peacefully with themselves and with their families. And as this podcast series continues, we will, even today, we will identify in more detail what some of these issues are that combat veterans have to deal with. I think I'll let Dr. Snyder take it from here.
Thanks, Doc. I want to go back to what you said about it being a post-combat normal state of affairs, because many of the vets that come to our program, once they've faced and acknowledged that they're dealing with the post-traumatic stress syndrome, they feel self-critical. They feel sometimes impatient with themselves, angry with themselves about having these symptoms. So I think it's worth noting that the symptoms of post-traumatic stress that I'm about to list, virtually every single one of those can be called a war zone skill over there, wherever there is. So a lot of what we talk about here is an issue where the changes in response to trauma are not a good fit with the environment, the civilian environment, the relationships, the need to deal with society. There are difficulties there, dissonance between the way the veteran has changed in the war zone and what society is demanding. So war zone skills over there are called post-traumatic stress symptoms over here. What happens in the wake of trauma, we'll talk about in some detail in a minute. But the person is rewired in virtually every way, and those changes are instantaneous and universal. So nobody who is in those types of conditions is immune to this. It happens to everyone, and veterans need to know that.
Okay. So
the symptoms of post-traumatic stress, just so that we're using a common vocabulary here, I think we should just list them briefly. They fall essentially into three areas, three clusters we call them. The first is the re-experiencing cluster, and these are symptoms in which the traumatic memory erupts or comes back on the person in some way. Probably the most common of these symptoms would be triggering or hyper reactivity in response to a stimulus. So, driving down a crowded freeway, there's something by the side of the road, and a veteran, say from Iraq, who's dealt with IEDs, goes into extreme fight or flight mode. Innumerable examples of that. Another very common symptom in this cluster is nightmares. PTS nightmares are very vivid and intense, so much so that a lot of times veterans fear going to sleep. Because what for most of us is a respite from a long day just becomes the most difficult part of the day for veterans with nightmares. There are intrusive thoughts, another symptom, where the memory comes back in a sort of ambushing fashion when you least expect it. And when it gets really intense to the degree that a person temporarily loses touch with reality and actually thinks they're back in the traumatic situation, we call it a flashback. do you want to say something, Doc?
Yeah, this is Doc again. In terms of the all of those re-experiencing clusters, we can sort of think of as triggers. And the events in civilian life that caused us to re-experience issues in combat can be something we hear, something we see, something that we smell. And it, in my case from Vietnam, the sound of a Huey just is an instant transporter from the United States back to Vietnam. For others that were, for instance, in Iran or Iraq, the sight of somebody on an overpass or the sight of garbage by the side of the road that could be an IED, that those kinds of re-experiencing phenomena are something that just, like Dr. Snyder just said, ambush you. You just, all of a sudden, they're there and there's nothing you can do about them.
What I wanted to add to that, a lot of times when we experience those things, like you said, they ambush you, but hopefully through this treatment, over the last 3 years, I've been in their treatment program. Let me introduce that, actually. I should say that. I've gone through the entire thing, the 12-week program that we're doing right now, the trauma therapy group that you do afterwards, and then after that, the aftercare group, and that's a year-long program. But between all of that, by the end of it, you still get ambushed by those thoughts. You still get attacked by those thoughts. But you can control it 10% better every time, 1% better, 0.5% better. And by the end of it, I'm not going to say that you're better, but you're better than you were. And that's, I just had to add that because you do. You get better than you were. You'll never not see the trash by the side of the road. One of my sniper friends was talking with me the other day. We drove down the road. We saw a stop sign, and the shadow of the stop sign was put into the road, and it looked like a lollipop. And for us, the shadow of a lollipop looks like a wire going to a bomb in the middle of the road. And I'll never not see that again. But this time, me and him laughed about it. Mainly because we were together, but still, it's one of those things that, you know, again, you can control it a little bit over time. So, sorry, guys, continue.
Absolutely. So the second cluster that's probably the most recognizable set of symptoms of post-traumatic stress is what we call hyperarousal, or being too ramped up. And that has to do with changes that occur directly in the brain after exposure to trauma. The hyperarousal cluster includes hypervigilance, which is being on the lookout for danger at all times, always looking twice, never quite trusting the environment. Because trauma has taught the survivor with post-traumatic stress that disaster can strike unpredictably out of the blue when you least expect it. So being on edge and looking out for danger is a major symptom. Sleeping poorly. A lot of times traumatic events in combat occur at night, so people tend to be more ramped up at night. But sleeping in general is very poor. Typically 3-4 hours of broken sleep is kind of the norm. Being angry easily, being irritable, another hallmark of the condition. Anxiety, which can be triggered or not, often escalating to panic levels, is characteristic. And because of all these stresses that the person experiences all the time, concentration and attention, memory suffer. So that's another characteristic feature. And then the third area, in 2013, when the fifth edition of the Diagnostic Manual, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM-5, came out, a couple of important things happened. The most important was PTSD, I'll use the D deliberately because that's the diagnostic nomenclature. PTSD was moved from its longstanding position as an anxiety disorder to its own category, trauma-related disorders, which is important because for many, many years, not only the understanding of PTS, but the treatments developed for it emphasized anxiety. Anxiety is certainly a pervasive feature of the condition, but there are much deeper emotions that we're going to talk about that fuel that continuous anxiety. So that's one thing that happened. And the other thing is the avoidance cluster, what was the third cluster, got broken into two parts. One is deliberate avoidance, and the other is negative changes in thoughts, feelings, behaviors. Which are kind of automatic, so and often operate without the person being aware of it, and certainly without the person being able to control it. So avoidance of any situation that reminds the person of a trauma or that contains the high potential for a trigger. Classic example would be avoiding large family functions where Uncle So-and-so might ask you a stupid question. Did you kill anyone? Which will provoke enormous anger typically. So often veterans avoid dealing with the world, not so much because they fear what could happen to them, but what they fear they might do to others if their anger got triggered. Avoidance of the memories, avoidance of talking about trauma is perhaps one of the most difficult symptoms to address. It is the symptom probably that impedes treatment. Guys don't want to talk about this stuff. I should say guys and gals. Women, of course, are now in war zones and suffer from post-traumatic stress also. But not wanting to face your demons is a human thing. Nobody wants to open that container that Doc talked about, but it's necessary. And then there's the automatic changes in the way you think and feel. Emotional numbing. When I teach class, I'll ask veterans who would unhesitatingly give their life to save their family, and all the hands always go up. And then I say, all of you who would give your life to save your family, the ultimate expression of love, who still has trouble hugging? Who feels like an Iceman or a robot when somebody's arms go around them? That's emotional numbing. That's being flat. It doesn't come from apathy. Just like skipping funerals doesn't come from apathy. It's the opposite. Comes from having experienced overwhelming pain that this numbing is protecting them against. Okay, depression, pessimism, cynicism, mistrust, those are all part of the avoidance cluster where the person has sort of automatically acquired a darker view of humanity and their place in it. So those are the symptoms, and they don't just sit there. They don't just sit there statically. I think it's important to note that the symptom clusters of post-traumatic stress are a dynamic. They have a dynamic relationship. They play off each other and multiply each other. So, for instance, as we've talked about earlier, the symptoms ambush a person, and it leads a person to be even more anxious than they naturally might be in a triggering situation because they fear the eruption of these symptoms. It becomes this sort of horrible jack-in-the-box, and you don't know when it's going to pop up. So that increases the hyperarousal, and that in turn causes a person to avoid more. When you're more ramped up, you want to dial it down. So the symptoms are sort of a vicious circle, and treatment becomes necessary at some point to interrupt that vicious circle. Or as Doc said, treatment is a hazmat team to deal with that toxic spill when the container ruptures.
This is Doc Fink again. I want to back up just a second and talk, because we've used the term combat trauma. Combat trauma is the result of some horrific event that we participated in or witnessed in the theater of combat. It can be taking someone's life. It can be taking a combatant's life, a civilian's life, even a child's life. Because sometimes in war, that is necessary. Combat trauma is at the core of everything we're talking about. oftentimes a veteran is asked, why can't you just let it go? Why can't you just forget it? There is something that happens when you witness a horrific event in combat. There is a basic change in the in the neurons in the brain associated with that event, because every event is nothing more than a cluster of neurons. It's a memory. But when that memory, that combat memory, is laid down in the brain, there are intense emotions associated with it. Those emotions are often fear, helplessness, anger, and the intensity of those emotions causes neurotransmitter-like chemicals in the brain to be released, which sears, literally sears, that combat memory into your brain. And that combat memory will be there forever. We cannot undo that, even in therapy. What we do, however, in therapy, is teach the veteran to live more peacefully with that memory. And we'll talk about the mechanisms of therapy that we employ in our program. And those mechanisms are miraculously successful. Thousands of veterans have been through our program, and they have all been helped in a remarkable way. Let me turn it back over to Dr. Snyder.
Thanks, Doc. I guess this is probably the appropriate time to start transitioning to talking about the therapy. But first, I just want to mention a couple of other things. As Doc said, trauma changes the brain. It also causes a sort of a permanent disconnect between what's called the limbic system, where emotions predominate, and the frontal lobes, or the cortex of the brain, the bark, where what we call higher order functions that are we characteristically think of as human, where they reside. So, reasoning, self-inhibition, doing cost-benefit analyses of behaviors, moral values, moral reasoning, all those things are sort of frontal lobe cortex functions. And so what we have is the limbic system sometimes floods our higher order thinking with raw emotion. That seared memory Doc talked about just comes flying out and kind of temporarily drowns out other mental phenomena. Or sometimes it seems like the frontal lobe has had enough and just kind of hits the main kill switch and the person is flat or numb. So trauma expert Judith Herman says this is the dialectic of trauma. You're either flooded or numb. Trauma also changes the way a person believes and sees the world. Basically, three assumptions are shattered or shaken by traumatic experience. One is the idea that the world is safe. The analogy I like to use in class is, let's say you and I sit down next to each other on a passenger airliner. You have survived a plane crash and I haven't. And you're sitting there nervous, shaking, and I say, hey, don't worry about it. You know, the chances of a domestic airliner going down are about 1 in 15 million. And that doesn't reassure you at all. And why would that be? Well, because I haven't experienced the plane crash. Therefore, statistics are very reassuring to me. I know that the chances are 1 in 15 million. What do you know? As a plane crash survivor, you know that it happened before, and it damn sure could happen again. So the way trauma survivors carry the knowledge of the world's danger is far more gut level. And as I said earlier, furthermore, they know that trauma can erupt without any warning, without any ability to anticipate or control it. So in other words, death is always a threat in a much more profound way. It used to be called death imprint in the early days of the formation of the diagnosis. So the idea that death can strike at any moment is burned into your brain. The second related assumption that gets shaken is that others are good.
Unfortunately, from Vietnam forward, the major conflicts the United States has been engaged in are guerrilla wars, in which women and children are, and old folks are used as combatants in various kinds of guerrilla ways. So it's not just uniformed enemy that our veterans have come to mistrust. It's human beings in general. And the third belief that gets shaken is the idea that I am good. It's a terrible irony of war that some of the most disciplined, competent, and caring people in our armed forces end up in positions of responsibility where they run up against events that nobody can control. Okay, so the more you care, the more you want all your guys to get home, the harder it can be to come home without being emotionally scarred. Survivor guilt is probably the most common example of the I am good assumption being shaken, asking oneself, why did I come home and he or she didn't? And then, of course, war forces people's hands to have to make terrible choices between a bad and a worse option. And often under extreme stress and on the spur of the moment, an action has to be taken. Killing other folks, even in the context of war, it's been studied and pretty conclusively shown that post-traumatic stress tends to be higher among folks who have had to kill, with all other stressors being comparable. So feeling like a good person coming out of the combat zone is, I would say, virtually impossible for those with strong morals.
Doc, this is Doc Fink again. Let me illustrate that in a rather vivid way. There was an armored column. This has occurred in Vietnam, moving through a village when they came under fire from what was quickly, at least the one of the gunners on a 50 caliber machine gun, which is a very large caliber gun, realized that the fire was coming from in the middle of a group of civilians that had been herded together, villagers. And there were Viet Cong that were using the villagers as a shield and were firing on the American armored column. And the guy was on 50 caliber, said, "Those cowards, those bastards, are using the civilians as a shield. There's nothing I can do. I can't fire into that group of civilians." At that time, an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade, went by his armored vehicle and missed them by about 2 feet. And instantly, he had no choice but to open up with a 50-caliber machine gun into that group of civilians. As much as he didn't want to do it, he had no choice. That was an experience that not only will he live with forever, but he lived with even more uncomfortably when he came home from combat and had young children of his own. And he couldn't help at times but look at those young children and not remember what he did in Vietnam. Those are the kinds of horrible events that in therapy we can help a veteran learn to live with more peacefully. We can't make it go away, but we can help them live with it more peacefully.
Thanks, Doc.
When I hear those kind of stories and I think about that stuff, one of the things I said in the group, and I still believe it is, it's like if you had a bowl and it was full of one piece of rice and a bottle of Tabasco sauce. And every time you go in the group and you talk in front of people and you think about it, they help you add one more piece of rice. And if you do it 10,000 times, which is what happens over the couple years that we're there, you finally have a bowl of rice with Tabasco in it. And it doesn't make the Tabasco taste go away. It doesn't make you stop feeling the pain. But it becomes tolerable. It becomes better than a bowl of rice just full of Tabasco by itself. And that's what we have now in those of us who've been through the entire group therapy session. And that's what we hope for you. So, again, I'll turn it back over. I have to add my 2 cents.
Thanks, Joe. So let's talk a little bit about therapy. I think, first of all, it's important to establish why one should seek therapy. If somebody out there is listening who is being urged by loved ones, family, friends to go get help, why might that person resist? you know, part of it is universal human nature, not wanting to, face horrible memories, especially after a period of time where the person has developed these probably fairly elaborate and effective avoidance systems. Why should you throw that away to confront it? And the other thing that I think is a major reason, probably the major reason that people don't want to get help for this, that combat vets avoid it, is because it is a military maxim, a military principle to stuff your pain and continue to do your job. You know, in Vietnam they said, don't mean nothing. In the current wars, suck it up and drive on. So it feels not only embarrassing, but in some ways weak and wrong for veterans who seek help, like they're trampling on some sort of moral code by opening up about stuff. And I respect that, but I would say that it boils down to one simple thing. If post-traumatic stress sufferers could think their way out of it, could will it away and get out of it on their own, they would. That's their nature. But it simply is not a problem that can be dealt with by oneself. And so the task becomes redefining courage. It's necessary to redefine courage to get help. And my stance is the following. If it's there and it's not going away, which is the case, it takes more courage to face it than not. It takes more courage to go after it rather than wait for it to go after you. Marines are trained to go towards an ambush. If they get ambushed, they don't run. They go towards the ambush and try to eliminate the main weaponry. So that's what's happening in post-traumatic stress. It's ambushing you, and rather than wait for it to come and get you again, you go and get it in therapy. So I want to talk about our psychotherapy that we offer in our treatment program and what we aim for. A lot of post-traumatic stress-related treatments aim for symptom reduction, anger management classes, anxiety reduction, and that's all valuable. We don't talk about a cure in our program because that implies, cutting something out like a surgeon takes out a tumor. And that's not possible. As both Joe and Doc have said, these memories are seared into one's brain and can't be eradicated. But we do talk about healing. That's our ultimate aim here. And what do I mean by that? In essence, a process by which a person comes to terms with their trauma, accepts it, understands it in the context of what happens commonly in war and how it affects a person. Basically a reckoning with one's trauma events so that one can carry it more peacefully. A lot of times what this involves is dealing with unresolved guilt and grief and shame issues that have arisen from the contexts of trauma. For instance, if someone's post-traumatic stress is mainly based on the loss of a buddy in war and all the survivor guilt around it, we have to do certain things to repair what is a severed connection between one and the person or persons that one has lost. I think that this is a good time to interject that more and more in the last several years, the mental health field has caught up to what our program has known for a long time, which is at the heart of trauma is what we call moral injury, a term that Dr. Shea, that Doc mentioned before, Dr. Jonathan Shea came up with. Basically, it involves traumatic events that cause a transgression against one's most deeply held moral values. Thou shalt not kill, for instance. In the case of a lost buddy, there are things that one has to do to essentially speak to that person and voice their feelings. We'll come back to that in a minute. In psychotherapy, I'm going to have Doc talk in detail about it in a second, but what happens in the healing process is we can't change the memory that exists. We can't alter the memory itself. We can change the way that memory exists in the mind in connection to other memories. Every time a person comes in to, we use a group therapy model. Every time the person comes into group and talks to 8 or 9 other combat vets dealing with other things and speaks about their trauma, the mind is a tremendous, tremendously powerful thing in making associations between events. So when you talk about something horrible in the context of a safe group, the mind starts to make associations between the original horrible memory and the safe memory of talking about that event without being judged, without falling apart, without becoming suicidal or homicidal. These are often fears that vets carry about what will happen if they take the lid off it. And when they find out that those horrible things don't happen and that other veterans can hear it, they start to form new memories that are a combination of the horrible trauma memory and the memory of talking about it safely, as I said. So for the rest of one's life after trauma therapy, one is no longer alone with the horrible memories. I had a guy say war creates its own private hell for everybody. And that is true. PTS boils down sometimes to a condition of very profound isolation. So as Dr. Jonathan Shea says, the core issue is to communalize our grief. We all have to help each other carry the burden, which paradoxically lightens one's own. So anyway, for the rest of one's life, one is no longer alone with those memories. When the trauma memory is triggered, so is the memory of safely surmounting it. So I'm going to have Doc talk about what that process entails. Again, we use a group therapy model with about 9 combat vets, and I'll have Doc speak about the specifics.
I went through the program in 2009. And something Dr. Snyder just said triggered an analogy that I've often used. It was used, this technique was used by the American Indians. It was called a talking circle. And after a battle with the cavalry, the Indian braves would return and there would be, the whole tribe would gather around a bonfire and the braves would talk about the trauma that they had experienced that day. And in doing so, the trauma becomes communalized. Now the tribe owns the trauma. The brave no longer owns it individually. And in post-traumatic stress, that is a horrible nightmare that we live with. We own that trauma, and it's the last thing in the world that we ever want to discuss. But in small group therapy, we are able to do that. It may take months to develop enough trust amongst this small group of, say, 6, 7, 8 veterans to be willing to begin to share. But as you share, you are relieving yourself to some degree of the burden of carrying that alone, and the other veterans in the group help you carry it. They support you. Talking about the trauma is very important. It's really the first stage in beginning to heal from combat trauma. A even more significant event is when we get to the point in trauma therapy when we can actually write a narrative about the traumatic event. If it's a situation where there's unresolved grieving or unresolved loss involved, when our buddy right in front of us stepped on a landmine and all of a sudden turned into pink mist right in front of us and we never had a chance to say goodbye or never had a chance to grieve him, we now have an opportunity to write a letter to him and tell him what we think, tell him the way we feel, tell him the way we've lived with those memories for decades. And in doing so, it's taking the sharing of the event verbally in therapy to a new level, because at its core, trauma is between you and someone else. There is a bond, an emotional bond between you and somebody else. I don't care whether it's a civilian or your buddy or a Vietnamese combatant, an enemy combatant. There's a bond that is shattered by trauma. And the therapy process, from one sense, is a process by which we reconnect with that person with whom the bond has been shattered. And letters, the letters that we write to these individuals are a way of reconnecting.
One of the things that was said in my group that I really loved was it's a way to carry the people differently.
Yeah.
And whether it's an enemy soldier that you had to kill, whether it's a friend of yours that you lost, you learn to carry their memory in a different way to where it's not painful anymore. You can think of them, well, I'll just leave it in a different way because, again, the docs can tell you more about it than I can. But that was, you know, it was one of the most beautiful things I ever heard because it reminded me that you don't have to be tearing yourself up when you think about somebody. You can think about them as they were and in a good way. And a lot of the guys, when they wrote their letters, they say they had a cathartic moment where they could see that person in a dream that night in a different way. They could see them sitting under a tree relaxing, whatever the case may be. But it helped them to see them differently and to carry them differently.
Thanks, Joe. I'm going to add to that. This is Doc Fink again. The process, from a personal perspective, the process of combat therapy is extremely emotional. It's emotional. It's hard to imagine a group of 7 or 8 or 9 combat veterans sitting in a circle and actually almost all of them crying or with tears in their eyes. But that's how difficult and that's how intense this therapy gets. And it's that intensity that's part of what makes it work. You have to develop tremendous respect and trust in the other veterans in the group before you're willing to open up and share/cry.
I don't mean to say this over dramatically, but it's just the truth. It was burned in and you have to burn it out.
As Doc said, the process of healing, when it reaches its most critical point with the letter writing and reading, is incredibly intense. It represents almost a complete 180 turn from what happens to loss in the combat zone. I don't think we mentioned earlier, we should have. Grief is an emotion that requires peaceful circumstances, really, to go through. It's a situation in the war zone where if one let oneself feel the full depth of loss and come apart at the seams emotionally for a while, then you're not only compromised yourself, but you compromise the people around you. So grief gets stuffed. And so we're asking guys to do the dead opposite of what every fiber in their being has been trained to do by trauma. So that's part of the drama, so to speak, of this process. It's incredibly powerful and dramatic. It's important to note that the trust, to reiterate, that the trust that is built is absolutely central to this process. And over the course of several months, before the letter writing typically begins or becomes prevalent in the group, the discussion of trauma is crucial because everybody has to have a context for the letters. Everybody has to know the basic stories so that the letter will make sense. In essence, everybody in the group has to become worthy of hearing such a personal and profound statement as the letters represent. I think my personal experience is that the writing of letters must be incredibly difficult for our vets, but often I hear that the reading it aloud is the most difficult part. I think it's also the most healing part because now we have a reconnection of bonds between the person and whoever they have unfinished business with from the past, but also a strengthening of the bonds within the group. So the relationships are healing on those two levels. It feels to me sometimes almost like a eulogy is being delivered in the reading of these letters, with an honor guard present, and that being the rest of the group, especially in the case of lost friends, the person reading the letter is going on the record, so to speak, and others are bearing witness to that loss like we do at a funeral. So there's a feeling, I think, of laying somebody to rest who has not been at rest. for a long time. And as Joe alluded to, sometimes a marker or an indicator that the real healing has been accomplished is what happens to one's dreams. Nightmares often transform into a more peaceful version. They spontaneously change into something signifying that peace has been achieved. So somebody that, say, one of our veterans had to kill a Viet Cong who turned out to be a teenager, and he dreamed about him for years and years and felt tremendous guilt and remorse about it. And after he wrote and read his letter, he dreamed that that enemy, that former enemy, was sitting peacefully under a tree, and he was passing by, and the enemy smiled and waved as if to say, "You've dealt with me. You've laid me to rest. Thank you for that." So, transformation dreams we're going to talk about later. Dr. Keenan has a number of examples that are very powerful and moving.
Doc Fink again. There's Dr. Snyder just referred to reconnecting with someone else, reconnecting with somebody in the combat zone. Oftentimes, the person that we are most in need of forgiving is ourself. And of all the events that I've heard talked about in trauma group over the years, one of the most difficult subjects for veterans is rape. Whether the veteran was a participant or whether the veteran merely witnessed an event which he could not stop, it is a type of trauma that is torturous to live with and has implications in one's personal life that can last for decades, especially when the veteran has children and one of those children is a young lady. That topic is one of the last topics that a veteran that you'll ever hear come up in a trauma focus group, but it is critical if you're carrying that kind of a burden to get it out and to get to the point where you can forgive yourself so that you can live a more peaceful life.
Thanks, Doc. That just triggered a statement by a vet that I worked with many years ago. I think that epitomizes this profundity of shame and guilt around events like rape, like killing, like desecration of bodies, like torture, all the things that are taboo, so to speak. And what this veteran said after his second tour in Iraq was, "I feel like I forfeited my membership card in humanity." So therapy has to reverse that. Therapy has to deal with that centrally, that sense of forfeited humanity. Trauma is an experience. You can't just think your way out of it. You have to have a new experience to do something decisive with that trauma. So therapy is intellectual in the sense that you do write and read and think about and talk about things, but far more central to the healing is the new emotional experience of being with people who understand and don't judge. Therapy is aimed at regaining one's membership card in humanity.
Well, I really wanted to thank you guys for coming in today, and we definitely will be doing the entire 12-week program. I want to hear what you guys think out in the world here in Radioland. I'd really love it if you guys got on Twitter and talked to us. It's at Post Combat Normal. On Facebook, it's also Post Combat Normal. Search us out. We're going to have a website up and running really soon. And please, like us on iTunes. Get it out to your friends. Please pass this out to as many people as you can. Again, Doc Snyder, thanks for coming in.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Joe.
And Doc Fink, thank you very much for coming in.
It's my pleasure also.
All right. Hey, that's wrapping it up today. And thank you guys very much for listening. Again, please pass it on to your friends who need it.